I'll go back to the zinc Newton thing.
Yes, please, tell us about the, what your first impression was of Mr. Newton, and his first impression of you, obviously, was a favorable one.
Right, well, he, we met there at Daytona Beach, and he'd asked Zink, well, you know, how come your goddamn car goes so fast? And then Zink, of course, said, well, you know, Larry here, who works at Packard, he's helped me, and, you know, he's an old racer. So Newton said, what the hell are you working for a goddamn company like Packard? Why don't you come work for a good company? I said, well, I mean, are you offering me a job? He says, well, he says, no, I really can't offer you a job. He says, but what you ought to do is go see Harley Earl. He'll give you a job.
What year was this?
This was in 1956.
So Earl was still the head of GM Design.
Yes, he was. Mm-hmm. So I said, well, Mr. Newton, would you put in a good word for me? Mm-hmm. He said, oh, yeah. He says, sure will. So, you know, that was about the end of that. And he said, well, getting back to the car, he said, what all did you do to the car? Mm-hmm. I said, well, he says, how'd you get that thing 500 pounds lighter than a, you know,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. I guess it was all over 600 pounds lighter than the factory cars.
Incredible.
And
all done by acid etching.
Well, part of it, and then just a lot. The factory cars had the stock upholstery and the door trim panels, and they had floor mats, and they had other things which were all scraped out of this one.
Mm-hmm.
And all of the undercoating was scraped off.
Wow.
And I mentioned the acid etching. He said, "Well, where the hell did you get that done?" I said, "Well, right in Detroit."
What was the name of the company, by the way?
I forget the name of it.
Are they still in business?
I think they are.
Are they? Uh-huh. Still in that type of business? Huh?
Yeah, they do that type of work. I think it's more metal treatment than,
uh-huh.
than lightning things.
Yeah, right. They're a little more sophisticated.
So then there was an aerodynamic device that we didn't really know. We were having some problems with the cooling. I had closed the air and the grill intake way down to a minimal size.
Mm-hmm.
And
to reduce drag?
Well. But that, you know, I didn't know any better. We just figured, well, if the air wasn't going in the compartment, then it would, you know, it would be less drag.
Right.
I wasn't really sure, so
mm-hmm.
I found a piece of a 2-inch bed rail at a junkyard.
Yeah.
We'd bolted this down underneath the front of it to act as a deflector to direct air into the radiator.
Mm-hmm.
And what I didn't know is that we'd actually affected a front spoiler.
Oh, I
and,
see.
It was really working. It so
was it completely by partially by accident?
Yeah, it was totally by accident. But I never knew what we really had until much later. You know, in the years at GM, when I was working on the Corvair, we found out that by adding a device on the Corvair, it suddenly took the car. The Corvair would run about 97 miles an hour, just flat out downhill or whatever. That's all the faster it'd run. When you added this front spoiler to the Corvair, the front end lift decreased, and the speed picked up to 107. So, you know, that was the first time we really found out what I'd done at Daytona. You know, uh-huh. what it was all about. We knew the car ran faster. We didn't know really why. And then it was about that time the NASCAR invented the ground height clearance check.
Oh, yes.
Which involved a box that had to slide under your car on a stick. If it didn't slide under your car, then your car had to be jacked up.
Oh, that was their rule of or their test.
Right.
Yeah. Had there been, so there had not been a front spoiler until then?
I don't really believe so. If there had been, I think they were all strictly by, you know, just by accident that they'd happened. And this was strictly by accident.
Isn't that interesting? Had there been rear spoilers up to that point?
No. NASCAR probably started adding the rear spoilers to basically to slow cars down, and I don't think they really realized what the spoiler was doing. They were adding this so-called thing they felt was an air brake, and what in effect it was doing, it was actually reducing rear end lift and also reducing drag.
Oh, uh-huh.
Instead of slowing the car down, it was probably speeding the car up.
You, your eyes light up when you think of those days. I suspect that racing has always been a passion.
Oh, yes, it has.
Yeah.
It's, the passion comes from the base thing wanting to win and being more clever than the other person.
which as part of your unfortunate reception in this country you had to do and as a young man.
Right, well, it's to race and to, you know, basically to win. And
to excel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's to just, well, if you, whatever it takes, if you're in a design contest, to do a design that's better than the other guy. And
right.
If it's in a race, find, and if, it's always to look for a, if there isn't a mechanical advantage, then find it, or if the mechanical advantage is in aerodynamics, or it's in, you know, lessening the friction, or taking away weight, like in a drag race, it's, if you can get rid of some weight while your car's going to go faster.
Can you describe for our future listeners the place that racing was beginning to take in automotive planning and promotion at this time?
Yes, it was, you know, the Ford adage was race on Sunday, sell on Monday. That was kind of one of Iacocca's, you know.
Shibboleths.
I don't really know if he, I don't think he really coined that, but he used it.
Yeah.
And that was pretty much happening on a fairly large scale.
Uh-huh.
And people's, GM's budgets were probably still more than anybody else's.
Racing,
you know, even in the years when they weren't supposed to be racing, they were spending millions of dollars.
You were under some sort of constrictions in those days, didn't you?
Right, there was an AMA ruling that...
American Manufacturers Association.
Right, that everybody was trying to adhere to, but nobody really did.
Uh-huh.
And then, I guess there finally came a real falling out, and then everybody did adhere to it for a few years. And then slowly they went away from it.
A lot of Sub Rosa testing and
right.
Racing under concealed
right, like
processes.
The Chaparral cars were all basically that Jim Hall ran.
Tell us a bit about the Chaparral. You had something to do with that, did you not?
Yes, I did.
Indirectly.
Well, the Chaparral, when they went into the mid-engine cars, that's where my involvement started.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a mid-engine design that they'd worked with GM styling on,
mm-hmm.
With the Bob McLean. And all I wanted to do was fly. It was the idea of the inverted airfoil. It was to give a downforce, and it didn't work. So.
Uh-huh.
They got involved with Frank Winchell at Chevrolet R&D, and I got involved with them, and we more or less fixed the car so it would stay glued to the ground,
mm-hmm.
and the drag was quite high.
Did you invert the...
Well, we had to just kind of redo the whole design and,
mm-hmm.
You know, more or less go to the front spoilers and
mm-hmm.
rear spoilers, and that was basically the early age of the ground effects where they were... using, you know, then the use of wings to push down on the vehicle.
Mm-hmm. Wings in what way do you mean?
Well, they had a very large rear wing. Well, first there was a rear spoiler that would articulate, so it would give you downforce in the corners, and you could trim it out on the straightaways when you didn't need the downforce.
Mm-hmm.
And we went from that. It went to a real high-mounted wing that took the wing up out of the airstream,
mm-hmm.
and then the supports actually went right into the upright, so there was, you weren't bottoming the suspension and the car out. The ground downforce was right onto the upright, right to the track. And these were worked out so although the wings were only in the rear, they transferred into the front suspension also, so
mm-hmm.
it gave the car total downforce. In fact, when Hall went to the sucker car with the auxiliary power plants that ran the blowers. Even that, those cars with the suckers didn't have quite as the same, didn't have as much downforce as his wing cars.
You call them suckers? Do you mean the air vents, the air intake vents?
Yeah, well, there were air intake. There was actually a seal all the way around the bottom of the car.
Uh-huh.
And then the air was all sucked out of this vacuum underneath the car with these mm-hmm. Auxiliary power plants.
Mm-hmm.
Which also sucked up the track and dirt and everything else. So.
Ah, I see.
So they finally banned those because they would make...
Too dangerous.
They're pretty dangerous.
Yeah, yeah.
If you're trying to follow one of those cars, well, you'd just get, you know, it'd be like in a stone storm.
Mm, gosh, yes.
So they finally banned those cars. But,
I believe it was an exciting time for you.
Yeah, it really was.
Chaparrals were pretty well received, weren't they?
Right.
They won some pretty big races.
Right, they won a lot of races, and okay, the Fords would run in big endurance races, mm-hmm. and they couldn't compete with the Chaparrals in the shorter races. And then finally at Sebring, the Fords would run down the straightaways at 208 miles an hour, and the Chaparral's top speed was 151. The Chaparral would run 151 all the way around the track.
Oh,
and they'd enter the corners, and they'd exit the corners, and they would just leave the Fords in their dust. So the people at Ford automatically said they had to have 600 to 700 horsepower to be that fast.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, they only had 430 horsepower.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty much vehicle dynamics doing the job for them.
It wasn't the horsepower.
It wasn't the horsepower.
It was the articulation of the...
They would... they had more cornering force, they had good brakes, mm-hmm. and to get the good cornering force, they suffered with higher dynamic drag. So mm-hmm. the top speed was only 151,
mm-hmm.
but they had run through the corners at almost 151 also.
Really?
So,
but the Chaparral still beat them.
The Chaparral won by a sizable margin.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it was in a complete deluge of rain. It became a boat right at the end of the race.
What race was this?
The Sebring, 12-hour Sebring race.
What year?
1965.
65, yeah.
Chevy Research and Development had done a lot of work on the electrical system. All the systems, all the electrical systems were completely sealed in a material called seal peel. They'd make up, with masking tape, they would make a gate, and they'd pour this hot seal peel, this liquid plastic in, and seal the whole electrical system.
So there's no interference from the elements?
No, so, you know, in the... So the cars ran almost full of water. They finally had to cut holes in the floor pan so the water would drain out.
That was an incredible race. I've seen films of that.
Yeah, it was just...
Who was the driver team who won it?
That was Jim Hall and Hap Sharp.
And they were the GM sponsored.
Right.
And arriving Chaparrals.
So. Right.
Let's go back, Mr. Shinoda, to the beginning of your days at General Motors. That would have been about 1956.
56.
Yeah.
That was September.
So what was your reception by Mr. Earl? Did you get an interview with him?
Well, at first I put together a portfolio and took it over, and I asked to have an interview with Mr. Earl, and they said, well, they all laughed at me and said that was totally unlikely, but we'd have somebody look at my portfolio.
And Knudsen's recommend preceded you?
Yeah, his recommended preceded me to Mr. Earl's office, but it hadn't filtered down.
Yeah, it hadn't filtered down yet.
No, so they were actually rotten. You know, they let me sit in their employment office lobby.
This is downtown. You weren't
no,
at
no,
the
no,
tech
no,
center.
This is at the tech center.
Oh, it just opened then?
Yeah, they just opened.
Yeah,
they let me sit there for the first day all day long, from 8 in the morning till 5. And they never offered lunch or anything.
Uh-huh.
So I read every piece of information, periodical they had, plus all their different hospitalization plans and what have you.
Yeah.
And then they told me, well, could I come back the next day? So I came back the next day and I brought my own reading material and my own lunch.
Good for you.
And then about 4 o'clock they came out and told me they couldn't see me. On the third day they came back, I went back, and they came out, they were nice. They came out right before lunch and said, well, the answer is no. I said, well, can I have my portfolio?
Mm-hmm.
So, well, why do you want that? I says,
it's yours.
It's mine.
Yeah.
And I said, well, okay. So they went and got my portfolio. And I said, they wouldn't give me any reason.
No reason? Who are these people? Personnel people. Yeah, okay.
I said, well, who saw my portfolio? I said, well, Mr. Andrade saw your portfolio.
That was Stan Andrade.
No, it was...
No.
Jules Andrade.
Jules Andrade. A-N-D-R-O-T-T-I or A-T-T-I?
Yeah. O-T-T-I.
Yeah. Right. Now he was sort of Earl's
right-hand man.
Right-hand man, yeah.
And so I left and I was, I really felt pretty poorly about the whole thing. So I wrote him a letter.
Andrade?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And he had never seen my portfolio.
Oh my God.
So he invited me back in and I came in. He looked at the portfolio. He just opened it up, and of course the opening shot was the 56 a winning car at Indianapolis. Mm-hmm. The car, and then on the opposite page was a crew standing by the car, and I was in the picture. Mm-hmm. That's as far as he went. He says, just a minute. Mm-hmm. And he left, and about 15, 20 minutes later, he came back with Mr. Earl.
No. Did he describe Mr. Earl physically?
Mr. Earl, physically, he was probably 6'6", and he was, you know, just, he was awesome, because mm-hmm. he was a long legs, very large body, mm-hmm. but you know, his legs were much longer. And then he probably wore about a size 6 and 7/8 or 7 hat, so his head was quite small for a person that big, so it made him look even larger. And
fashionably dressed, I understand.
Yes, very fashionably dressed. And in fact, his shoes never looked like, it looked like they had shoe trees in his shoes all the time. They're never, you can never see a crease in his shoes. And Mr. Earl walked in, and so he looked at my portfolio, opened it up, and he says, oh, that's you. And he turned the page, and here are all the sketches of the car, mm-hmm. the body design, and then
the racer,
and then the buck being done, mm-hmm. and the aluminum being hammered, mm-hmm. and then the finished car. And he says, it's as far as he looked, he says. Mm-hmm. So he says, well, he says, your friend Bunky Knutson says that we should really have you working for us. Yeah. He says, I really like what I saw. He says, how much more money are we going to have to pay you? Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm just kind of quickly calculated a $200 a month figure higher than I was making at Packard. Mm-hmm. I mentioned that, and he says, oh, is that all? He says, okay. He says, well, and then he told the personnel guy, he says, was the assistant. So you tell that fellow with the big ears, that was the guy that was in charge.
Was giving you the problem.
Give me the problem. Yeah. You tell that fellow with the big ears that we're going to pay Mr., and he couldn't pronounce my name. So he couldn't pronounce your notice, so he says, you can't pay this Larry fella so much. Mm-hmm. And it was about another $100 more than what I'd mentioned.
Right.
So I ended up going to work there for, I think it was almost $800 a month. And at that time, it was a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And he said, when can you start? Well, I had another job interview in Oakland with Kaiser Aluminum. Uh-huh. So I had to go there, and I wanted to go see my mother and have her see my portfolio. Mm-hmm. So I asked for a couple of weeks, mm-hmm. and he said, fine. So left, came back, and this Roger Martin, I don't think he ever, I don't think he ever liked me after that. He didn't like me before.
Roger
he
Martin.
Was he was the guy, the personnel
the
guy.
The personnel head, initially said no. Huh?
Yeah, he'd really give me a hard time.
Did you ever find out why?
No, I never did. No.
Never asked him. Huh?
No.
But so you were accepted. I take it the Kaiser Frazier, but the Kaiser did not. Interest you. Huh?
No, I went up. I did see him, and they this Frank Hershey had worked at Ford.
He was there?
Yeah, he was in charge of
it. What was he doing at Kaiser?
He was in charge of all their design.
Really? Had you not met him before?
Yes, I'd worked for him for a short time at Ford.
At Ford, you knew him at Ford, of course. He was in that GM contingent to come over.
Right.
What did Hershey say? Did he remember you?
Oh, he remembered me. And he made me an offer about what I was making, at Packard.
Uh-huh.
And
what would you have been doing? What kind of products?
Well, different things for Kaiser. It was they were in the shipbuilding, and they
right.
were doing
Had they gotten
housing.
Out of the automobile business by now?
Pretty much so.
Pretty
yeah.
much, yeah.
There were some automobile stuff, like decorative things they were still trying to sell, like yeah. sill plates and rocker panels and
mm-hmm.
things.
But yeah.
It really wasn't of much interest.
I couldn't put a patch on what you were hoping for at GM. But, yeah.
So I just had to tell them thanks, but no thanks, and I went down to Los Angeles.
What do you think of Hershey as a person? As a designer, perhaps?
Well, I didn't really know him that well. Yeah. He just struck me as kind of weird.
That's what I heard.
Yeah, it's kind of weird. But,
he's still alive.
Is he?
Yeah, he's moving from Arizona down there to Key.
What is he?
Well,
they can scratch each other's backs and
relive the old days. Well, what were your first assignments then, General Motors? How did it work out?
Well, the first assignment, I went into an orientation studio.
Mm-hmm.
And I was only there for about 2 weeks.
Oh.
and...
Was that the usual process?
Yeah, usually you were there longer. The first thing I did...
About 6 months at least.
Yeah. I did a, did kind of a wild Chevrolet sketch, and it had big wings, and it was, you know, had a big racing gas cap.
When you say wings, you mean that elevated...
No, 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 this was a V-shaped wing.
V-shaped, okay.
Well, it became the...
The gull wing.
The gull wing, but...
Okay, yeah.
Mine was just basically a wing shape, it didn't have the, bird look to it.
Right.
And,
The gull wing, didn't have the...
So they, evidently Mr. Earl had seen that, and he liked it, so, I come in on a Monday, and they said, "Well, you've been transferred, you're in Chevrolet Studio now." So I took my tab rate and went down there, and here this rendering sketch I did was on a, was on an easel, and they're working on a clay model. And, I was kind of really shocked. So then, so I was in Chevrolet Studio for...
What came of that incident?
That, basically, you know, from that vehicle that was, well, they were working on the, '58 Impala at that time, trying to finish it up.
Right.
So, and then there was work on the, doing the 59 cars.
Did that basically become the back, the rear end of the 59?
Well, yeah, part of it.
But that did have a gull wing effect.
Right.
Yeah.
And the front end became basically part of the Buick.
Really? Fascinating. All without attribution.
No, you know, just it was...
something you did as a staff designer.
Yeah, and it was case in point, well, the rear end, I had done another one that was very closer to the Buick, which 59 Buick ended up with.
Really? What was that?
And that was basically, a, you know, it was the shape that had, it had the wings, but they were, the one, the Chevrolet one I did came all the way into the center. Just was just a big V shape.
Yeah, I remember that.
And of course, it had round tail lights. It didn't have those, you know, teardrop shapes.
No, yeah.
The Buick ended up with the round lights.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a body section that really intrigued him.
Uh-huh.
And they were saying, well, of course, the Fisher body guys were saying you couldn't build it that way. Their welding guns couldn't weld the pinch seams.
Mm-hmm.
So I did a sketch, showed them, you do it the other way around, you'd weld it on the outside and you'd put a molding over it.
Uh-huh. What'd you call them, cinch seams?
Well, there were these spot welders would come in and they would pinch the pinch weld.
Oh, pinch weld, yeah.
The fenders were kind of fat, pillowy fenders on the 58.
Uh-huh.
And it was because they were seam welded on the inside.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I talked him into welding them on the outside and putting the molding over.
Yeah, what did they want that?
So, you know, they ended up, they liked the idea.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of set me on my way.
I could think so.
And then...
who was heading up to Chevrolet Studio at that time?
Claire McKeegan.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh. What kind of guy was he? I've heard a lot about him.
Well, he was, very gruff, but, you know, well, I don't know, outwardly, he was really a...
Yeah.
He was really a nice guy.
Was he? Despite all of his exterior gruffness.
Yeah.
Yeah. He take you under his wing, so to speak?
No, not really, but he, you know.
Tell me an arm length.
Well.
You're a little bit too progressive for him.
No, not really, but I got along fine with him.
Yeah,
you know, you knew that I could do the job for him, and so, of course, Mr. Earl was a past master of intimidation.
Was he? How would
he would walk in the studio and he would, and one day he came in and he says, no, all you fellas under 30, you stand on this side of the room. All you fellas over 30, stand on this side of the room. And of course he came and stood on the side of the guys all under 30. He says, see all them sons of bitches, they're all burnt out.
That's a neat trick.
Just think, when you become over 30, you might have to stand on this side of the room and be all burnt out like these guys.
Not very funny to the guys who are on the outside.
No.
Of the room. That was his little sadistic joke.
Oh yeah, and he would. And McKeegan would stand up so straight that he'd be crooked.
Really?
You know, he would stand up with attention, and usually his tie was always crooked, and he would say, "Yes, Mr. Earl, yes, sir, yes."
I guess that was a problem.
Mr. Earl was kind of like one word, Mr. Earl. You know,
oh, really?
It was not always Mr. Earl.
Yeah.
It was always Mr. Earl. You know, kind of. And. And he would sit in a chair. He did have these wire Bertoia chairs,
mm-hmm.
with just a wire frame.
What'd you call them again?
They're called Bertoia chairs.
Oh, Bertoia, yeah, okay.
And Charlie Earl would pick up the wings, and he would kind of walk along, and, because he was like he was, he didn't want anybody to pull a chair out from under.
Yeah.
And he would kind of lounge in his chair, and instead of turning his head this way, you would never do that. He'd kind of look over and say, "What do you think, fellas?" And Jules Andrade would say, "See, I think so, very good." You know, of course, he was Cuban, so.
Oh, he was?
Yeah, Andrade was Cuban.
He had a Latin accent.
Yeah, so he had a, "Yes, Mr. Rowe, I think so." And everybody would say yes, you know.
Of course.
And he would point with his foot. Yeah, he'd sit in his chair and he'd point with his foot. The designs with his foot.
Point
of things with his foot. He wouldn't point with his finger.
It's his long legs.
He
utilized
them. Then his shoes were, you know, that somebody, a fellow named Stan Mott did a cartoon, and you know, and showed to Mr. Rowe with his shoes actually arched the other way, and that's almost how they were.
Really?
And
did he really have a good taste in clothes, or were they set kind of flamboyant?
No, they're
well tailored, good fabrics.
Good fabrics, and he was, you know, of course he was built kind of strange anyway, and the thing that always amazed me was. When he'd bend over, he'd never look like this, and he'd go.
Really?
Like his legs, his feet. And he'd always walk almost stiff-legged, and he'd kind of look like this. He'd look like this at things. And if you're standing behind him, I must have an enormous set of balls and a great big one.
Must be. Yeah.
But, you know, he...
Oh, that's funny. Was he ultimately fair? Was he ever?
No, I think in most cases he was fair.
Was he,
but
especially if you had talent.
Yeah, if you had talent, he would. Well, for a while there, they had to hide this Sparky Bonstead after he came back from Packard.
Well, what was the problem there?
Well, Harley Earl didn't like him.
Oh, I suppose last name.
This Bonstead.
Oh,
yeah, the one that was at Packard.
Oh, yes, okay. He came back to General Motors.
Yeah, well, he was a very close friend of McKeegan's, and
McKeegan
got him back in the GM.
Okay.
And also, I guess Ed Cole liked him.
Uh-huh.
But Harley Earl didn't like him.
Ed was then the chief engineer?
He was chief engineer of Chevrolet.
Yeah.
And,
What did Earl have against him?
Well, I don't know. Well, Sparky used to wear a red vest all the time and a bow tie. And I guess bow ties and red vests really bothered him.
Bothered Earl?
Well, it's like people with squeaky shoes.
Oh, yeah.
He'd say, you can't, you know, I don't want no son of a bitch working for me that hasn't paid for his goddamn shoes.
Yeah, that old story.
The old chunky shoes squeaked, they haven't paid for.
Yeah, right.
Or he didn't like people with red vests.
Red vests. But Bonstead insisted on wearing them, huh?
Yeah, he would insist on wearing the red vests, and so they had to hide him out.
Where would they put him?
Well, they'd put him in the back room, or they hid him for a while in the basement.
Yeah, your old studio.
Well, not one of my old studios, was in another section of the basement. But he was kind of, I think he was relieved when Mr. Earl retired.
He didn't have to hide anymore. Yeah. Now, Earl retired in 58, not too long after you got there.
Right.
Yeah. You were sad to see him go, I suspect.
Yeah, because, Bill Mitchell picked up, and of course he wasn't near as dynamic a person as Mr. Earl.
Yeah.
Mr. Earl could actually, well, He could he'd always intimidate Harlow Curtis.
Oh, really?
He wouldn't pat him on the head, but you know.
almost.
And then
Harlow at that time was president.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm, or chairman.
And Harlow's shoes were always, looks like he'd walk in water and they were dried up and they were kind of always kind of pointed.
Really?
His shoes were the opposite of Mr. Earl's. They're always pointed, all wrinkled and pointed.
That's true.
And then he used to wear gray suits most of the time.
Uh-huh.
And I think it was partially because he had a dandruff problem. He had this kind of he must have brilliant red hair at one point in time.
Yeah.
Because it was white and it was the sides were a little bit yellow. Uh-huh. His mustache was yellowish, but most of that was probably from nicotine stains.
He was a constant smoker.
He'd smoke and he'd hold a cigarette way and his teeth were all kind of, yellow.
Yeah.
And he'd hold a cigarette like this and he'd go, and then he'd blow the smoke through his teeth and he'd look up Mr. Earl and smile. With his one hand in his pocket usually, a cigarette. It was really funny.
Incredible confrontation.
Yeah. Really, in fact, Harlow would usually walk on top of the surface, the modeling rails.
Oh, I see.
So it would elevate him, four inches.
Above Curtis.
But so then he was still looking in Harley's, back pocket almost.
Well, General Motors is flying high at this point in the late 50s, aren't they? They're doing
pretty
well, I think.
Yeah, they were doing very well.
Beating Ford handily, except for 1 year, I think, 55. And Chevrolet is really fermenting, isn't it?
Right.
What's happening at Chevrolet at this time? At this point?
Well, this time they're doing, you know, they're doing all the different cars. They're into the Corvette thing, and then they're starting the, or just getting into the, while it was a Corvair and when they got into Camaro, but they were expanding the Chevy too. They're just increasing, making the line larger and larger.
Explosion. I suppose it would be, I think, helpful to students of design to zero in on your part at this point in the Corvair, the Corvette. It had begun a few years before you got there, had it not?
Right. It started, the first model was 53.
Can you sketch in a little bit about who the creator was, who was the person behind it, and how you eventually fit it in with their plans?
Well, the Corvette was started out